Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
When it comes to Christmas, we're used to Amazon, Walmart, the malls, large credit card bills, and we, you know, acknowledge Santa Claus. But do you know the sacred traditions of Christmas? Well, we're going to discuss with author and folklore historian John Matthews about his book, The Winter Solstice, The Sacred Traditions of Christmas. We're going to find out where Christmas came from, how it evolved into what it is today. But it had to start at the beginning. And it might help you people burned out on how Christmas has become more commercialized. Well, I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios, for the first time, author John Matthews.
Hi.
Hey, John, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Well, I'm great, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you. It's not too early, is it? No.
I guess they say over there, Happy Christmas, right?
Either works.
Either works. Well, I'm excited to have you part of this show because, you know, this is something not only fun for me and fun for the audience, but it's also, I love history, and Christmas has evolved so much, you know, in the centuries it's been celebrated, and but a lot of people don't know the sacred traditions of Christmas and where it came from, and I'd like to first start off by talking about how you wanted to create this book, The Winter Solstice.
Well, it was mostly because of what you've just said, that people didn't know about this. I mean, there are a lot of other books out there about the solstices. I did myself on the summer solstice as well, just to keep things balanced. but this is a time of year when we do all kinds of things without thinking why. You know, why does Father Christmas come down the chimney?
Right.
Why does he have flying reindeer? You know, why are we celebrating the birthday of one god when there are at least five others who also have birthdays on this day? And, you know, why do we do so many things? Why do we put up a Christmas tree? Why do we put up greenery? All of these questions had interested me as a folklorist. I'd studied them all. And I thought, well, you know, maybe a few other people will be interested. So, you know, along came the book.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you did this, too. And you're right. You're mentioning all these different things. And I just know through some of the other interviews I've done over the years that a lot of what Christianity, when they think it's all about Christmas, well, a lot of it came from paganism, and which I find so fascinating. But, well, let's take us into the time machine. Let's go back to where Christmas began, or at least the thought of Christmas and Santa Claus and all this. So where did it begin?
Well, probably realistically with the Stone Age.
Really? That far back?
Well, because the most important thing about it is the lighting of fires. People from the very earliest time, our ancestors, once they discovered fire, knew that it was important. Without it, you died. Simple as that. You needed to keep warm. So fire was a very important and a very sacred thing. And so the fire, the most obvious fire to those people was the sun. So when they looked up at the heavens and they saw the sun, they didn't know, of course, anything that we know now about that. but they realized there was something important about it. And so they celebrated it by lighting fires. And the fires that they lit round about the winter solstice were, in a way, to call out to the sun. I like it. It was to call out to the sun and say, come back, don't desert us. Because in that time, I think a lot of people probably thought, it's gone, because it gets lower and lower and lower in the sky. The days get darker for longer periods. And you find yourself thinking, is the sun ever going to come back? So what can I do to encourage it? So, of course, there were sacrifices, mostly animal. But most important of all were fires. The bigger the fire, the more likely the sun, the god of the sun, was likely to see you down there in your little tiny pinprick of a planet and come back and shine your light on them again and keep them going.
That's so fascinating. You would never think, Christmas began with Stone Age and fires.
Exactly. I mean, it's nothing like what we now recognize of Christmas, but I would say as much as, 70% of what we celebrate and do all the time at this time of year dates pretty much from the 19th century, or maybe the 18th at a pinch. But everything before that, the really powerful underlying things, are much, much older. From the Stone Age, of course, you jump forward through the great civilizations, the Persia and Rome and Greece and all of that, and each of them add something to that. I mean, we're used to celebrating the birthday of Christ, but in fact, we could equally be celebrating the birthday of Mithras, who was a Persian god worshipped by the Roman legions, who was also born on the 25th in a cave surrounded by shepherds.
Really?
That is an interesting thing in itself. I mean, Christianity borrowed a lot to make its own story. And of course, you can say that the actual story of Christmas fits very well into the mythology of earlier times. But somebody recognized that. Some people recognized that. So, as I say, we could be celebrating Mithras, Attis. We could do Horus for the Egyptians. Dionysus for the Greeks, and then overall there's the one called the Unconquered Sun.
So,
and that was a very nice image of Mithras there slaying the bull. The idea of he was sent down to Earth to slay the great bull.
Yeah.
And when he slew the great bull, by as you saw in that flash there of him cutting its throat, its blood went into the earth and made the earth healed and able to give forth all its goodness. And there's also a story in some of the mythology that Mithras also died and came back to life. So you have a lot of parallels with a much more familiar figure of Jesus Christ. So it's just one of the big layers, if you like, that we borrow from quite unconsciously. A Roman would have recognized that what you're doing is, you're celebrating Mithras. Great. We just keep on borrowing things through time.
I'm actually almost stunned by that. So, let me try to word this correctly. So Mithras was really this story was already there before the story of Christ, correct?
Yes, quite a considerable time before. It would have been at least 200 years BC.
Wow.
Came out of Persia originally. He was a Persian god, and the Romans adopted him, and the legions especially. And they went through some very rigorous kind of initiation ceremonies over several years, until they each one of which had a different name.
Right.
So they'd be called the Crow. They'd be called different things. And then finally they'd reached the point where they were fully initiated into the mysteries of Mithras. And these went on everywhere. I mean, wherever you go in the world, if you look at Roman ruins, you'll find somewhere a temple to Mithras.
Oh, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I'm trying to make the connection of the story of Mithras connecting Christ and then all of a sudden Santa Claus and Christmas. How did this all combine? I mean, that's where you're like, wait a minute, there's a lot of stories that are added to one day.
Well, I mean, the example we were looking at there of the gods is such a basic one. That, I mean, you know, by the time Father Christmas comes along, and he's quite old as well, a lot older than you'd think, and he's not just St. Nicholas or any of the other variations on that that you get in various different cultures.
Right.
He's much, much older. He is, in fact, was almost certainly a shaman from the very earliest times, because you can get stories, if you look into the history of shamanism, which I've done extensively, you find lots of stories about the shaman himself or herself climbing the tent pole in one of these great yurts or tents, climbing up and going through the smoke hole in the top, and then coming back down again with knowledge, wisdom, information, or gifts. So right there, you have straight away an image from a very, very early period of someone coming down a chimney, or a kind of chimney, with gifts. He would have been dressed in green, and interestingly, almost all the Santas were dressed in green until Coca-Cola came along and changed it to red. And before that, if you look at any of the older pictures of St. Nicholas or Santa Claus, he's always wearing green. There you go. Just like that, green cloak over a red thing, but still excellent.
Wow. So so Coca-Cola just made their him look like their can.
They basically put him into that color. They gave him the shape. They got an artist whose name I forget for the moment, but they got this artist to paint him. And that is the image that most of us, have very clearly in our minds now, the white beard, the white hair, the hat, the cloak and everything, all of which would have been present, apart necessarily from the white hair, at these much earlier times, because, of course, the shamans, particularly those of somewhere like Finland or, the more northern countries, would have been wrapped in a cloak, probably green or brown. And as I say, they climbed this sort of central pillar, the tent pole, which represented the connection between earth and heaven. So when your shaman climbed the ladder, he was literally climbing up to heaven, and he was going to speak to the gods and come back with a message for you. So this was the idea, the basic idea behind the idea of giving of gifts, and it grew out of that.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, obviously it became much more linked eventually with commerciality, which it still is. And we're all used to it, and I'm not knocking it. I love getting presents personally,
right.
but it's like in between. There's the more standard idea of St. Nick and the other characters mostly again from northern traditions of the saint who loved children and wrapped up little presents. Some would go around and drop them down the chimneys or put them through on the doorstep or through the window or whatever. And that was the idea, too, that where the whole idea of hanging stockings came from as well.
I think
that came out of Denmark, if I remember right. Certainly one of the northern countries.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to get back to the Christianity part of Christmas. But so Santa Claus started off, was it built off of St. Nicholas? The saint himself, or
no, much earlier,
much earlier,
going back several thousand years.
So how did they connect those two? Why do people say, oh, he came from Saint Nick? Where did that come from?
I think because you have to remember that Christmas as we know it began to take shape in the Middle Ages.
Okay,
that was when most of the things that we celebrate began to be gathered together. All the teachings, the wonderful story of the birth of Christ was grafted on to much earlier beliefs and ideas, and have obviously shifted those in different ways.
Right.
But it was more a question of, oh, look, that story is really interesting. There's the idea of this bringer of gifts, of knowledge, of wisdom. How about this St. Nicholas, who was a real character,
right?
And who really did exactly what we now think of as Santa doing all the time, you know, which was bringing gifts for kids. So he was the first to do that. And I think it caught on. I think the way people saw it was they just saw what a great idea it was. And of course, we had to balance it out in some in some countries where you had creatures like the Krampus.
Right, right.
A rather nasty, creepy kind of almost demonic figure.
Right.
who had to punish the children who weren't good. So even that early, again, you were getting the idea of not quite the naughty and nice list, but at least, you know, if you were good, you were likely to get a present. If you weren't, you weren't. So, you know, it was all there. It was just, and I don't think anyone, well, I know that no one person put all this together. It simply grew together. And this is the case in folklore. There he is, carrying the boy away on his back like that. And they've made him very clearly a devil.
I was going to say that would definitely not make you want to open your home to that creature.
It would really not. No, it would really not. And they've kind of played halfway through with it in some of the Scandinavian countries, where St. Nicholas would go around in a procession and he would be accompanied by what were called the sooty boys, mm-hmm. which were actually chimney sweeps. And they were, I suppose, the original and now very un-PC blacked up characters, you know. So they were, right. They'd go around with him, and they were kind of the naughty boys that were part of his entourage. But again, showed off the difference in characteristics.
So where did we touched on it, but the gift giving, when did that come into play? Was that also part of the Middle Ages, or was that later in the story?
No, it does come in. I think it starts once the idea of St. Nicholas began to spread.
Oh, okay.
Because he was the first one recorded, the first recorded person that we know of to do that in a specific way, mm-hmm. in that he would visit the houses of poorer families particularly and just drop a little extra something through the window. And that from that came the idea, particularly in the various Scandinavian countries, of putting your shoes out and having your shoes filled with gifts, because
they wouldn't want to put it in my shoes.
Yeah, well, probably not mine either.
Right.
But nonetheless, that was the beginning of that, and the same with the stockings. They came out of this period, and just the idea that, you know, that this kind of celebration, because it's all about celebrating the end of the year. Remember,
right.
And just as our distant ancestors were celebrating the solstice and the return of the sun, so our more recent ones were celebrating having survived another year at a time when, you know, if you were in the agricultural side of things,
right.
It was tough, hard work all the time. If you were involved, if you were the sort of more civilized end of things, if you like, they were probably at war most of the time.
Right.
So, you know, you had something to celebrate when you got round to this time of year. And then you had, on top of that, of course, the great Christmas story, which even though it had borrowed so much from much earlier times,
right.
You know, became fixed into this mold. And again, it's a great story. You know, I mean, there's no question. It's a fantastic story. And it all tied in with the idea of love and giving and all the things that the very first ages of Christianity represented. So, you know, it all just came together gradually over hundreds of years.
When did the day, December 25th, become the... Because, I mean, there's other parts I'm going to go back to, such as the Christmas tree and all that stuff. But when did December 25th, Christmas Day, combine the two of Santa Claus and celebration of Christ's birth?
Well, I mean, the date itself, as I mentioned earlier, comes really from the celebrations of several other gods at that time. Now, in actual fact, theologians have worked out that Jesus's actual birthday was during the summer.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too.
But
yeah,
they've tied it into this time, I think, because again, obviously the Mithras story has many of the same elements. If you went to the story of Horus, you had the virgin birth virtually. If you went to Dionysus, you had the kind of ecstatic quality of celebrating the wonder of Christmas. So in a way, they really quite consciously borrowed. We don't know exactly who first decided it was going to be the 25th, but I think it was probably a joint thing that was agreed upon by a lot of these medieval theologians who were sitting down and working out, you know, when it could happen, when was the best time for it. And they probably went, well, look, 25th of September, December, that's a good time.
Right.
You know, those other pagan gods that were dismissing, we don't need them anymore, but let's keep some of the ideas and let's bring it in together, you know, and make this whole slightly mythological sequence into something wonderful, which they did.
Why didn't they choose? I mean, there may be another celebration there, but why didn't they choose December 21st, the winter solstice?
I don't really know the answer to that one. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever come up with a particular reason.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of calendrical movements since then. Remember, we have the famous re-establishment of a new calendar in the Roman period.
Right.
Which according to, you know, people in this country, when it was finally introduced later on, they said, we want our missing 12 days back.
Right.
And those missing 12 days are very interesting because those
intercalary
days,
yeah,
as they're called, are in fact the 12 days of Christmas.
Yeah.
It would have been 14, actually, but we didn't count Christmas Day or Christmas Eve.
Oh,
so,
okay,
you know, therefore it's 12 days after that, leading up to Epiphany. So all of that is, and each of them has its own connections. You know, in the book, I wrote out ideas for people to celebrate each of the 12 days if they wanted to. We've always done it here. And I like to think there might be a few people out there who are celebrating Snow Day or Greenery Day or
right.
whatever, just to keep the spirit going, you know?
I love that. I love that. All right, so we've connected the two together. You know, man decided that. Just because they maybe wanted something to celebrate, because gift giving, you know, putting it in stinky shoes or shoes or in the stockings. But when did the Christmas tree become part of Christmas, and why put the gifts under the tree?
Well, the Christmas tree itself doesn't really come in until Victorian times.
So that's a big time, bit difference.
A big jump.
Yeah.
Before that, people would decorate their houses with greenery.
Mm-hmm.
Again, part of and I don't know really how much they were aware of what they were doing in a way, or how much was just a habit. But they were definitely, it came out of the idea that the greenery, especially evergreen, meant the return of life and the continuation of life. So we're back at that, getting to the darkest time of the year. We want the sun to come back. Let's light some fires.
Yes, please.
We want everything to keep growing. Let's put some greenery everywhere. And they did that. And there are all kinds of interesting myths behind some of those. I mean, the holly and the ivy, for instance, that we're used to hearing in the carol or used to hanging up. These were at one time considered to be godlike beings, represented by godlike beings who were rivals. So you get battles between holly and ivy at this time of the year in mythology, which is very interesting in itself.
No,
so,
that's great.
But all of that, all of the idea of just bringing in the green stuff, hanging it up everywhere. And then, of course, you've got mistletoe, which we don't do as much now, I think. And the whole idea of the kissing bunch and all of that, that came out of Druidry, which again is much earlier than Christianity. The Druids celebrated the power of mistletoe because they saw it as representing male fertility. I don't know whether you want me to go into detail on that or not.
Yeah, but please. No, I'm interested now because I've never honestly thought about where the mistletoe came from. That's
well,
interesting.
Well, I mean, mistletoe grows, it's a parasite. It grows on other trees.
Right.
But the Druids used to cut it at this time of year, and they had to cut it with a golden sickle, and they mustn't touch it with their hands, and it must not be allowed to touch the ground. So they had someone would stand under the tree with a cloth, and someone else would climb the tree with a golden sickle and cut the mistletoe, and it would be caught in the cloth, carried into the house, and then hung up in a bough called the golden bough. And the reason that the Druids felt so strongly that it was sacred was because they saw the white berries as like semen.
Oh,
and
really?
So they thought, this is a representation of the male power.
Wow.
Not the red berries of the holly, but the white berries of the mistletoe.
Let me see if I can find the...
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. I found it. Ah, oh, that makes sense. Okay. I see it.
Yeah, you can see the thinking there. There you go. There you go. We have one just like that in our house every year, and we keep it, and it stays up until the Twelfth Night,
mm-hmm.
and then we take it and hang it in another place where it stays all for the year, and then when we come round to the next time to get it, we get some fresh ones and we burn the old ones. So we're still doing a sacred action, which I think is the way it was done then as well.
When it comes to the Christmas tree itself, the decorations, of course, that kind of makes sense. You know, it's like, okay, now we can put up some, we'll decorate the tree as we're decorating inside the home. But the star on the top of the tree, I'm assuming that's the Star of Bethlehem?
Yes, I think so, yes.
I mean,
although it might have been considered to be, you know, the Star of Renewal again.
Yeah.
Because even our distant ancestors realized that the stars meant something. You know, they didn't know what they were, but they knew that they were important in some way. And obviously, the first Christmas tree was brought in from Germany by Prince Albert, the consort of Queen Victoria. And they were the first family to put them up. And of course, in those days, no electricity, so they put lighted candles on the tree. Quite dangerous.
I was going to say, how'd that work out?
Yeah, well, I wonder. We don't hear about stories of palaces burning down. But it became a focal point, and they put, I don't know why they chose to put the presents under the tree. I suppose it was a kind of logical thing to do, really, because it was becoming a focal point. And of course, people would sit around and they would sing carols,
right?
And it became the center. And at the same time, somebody came up with this idea of having Christmas cards. Again, these were at one point just a single sort of oblong of card like that with a pattern on it, and you'd write your message on the back, and off it would go. And that again so often featured pictures of the queen and the consort and her many children round the Christmas tree.
Right.
So it began to gather momentum, and people began to realize, hey, let's do that. It's nice, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's how traditions are built.
Exactly. You know,
maybe a good gesture, and then it just kind of stuck. Well, one of the big ones I want to know is with Santa Claus is, where did the elves come in?
Oh, the elves.
Yes.
Literally, that's Victorian again. Because I mean, partly it's the song, you know, the Samuel Clemens song,
right,
about Santa and the reindeer and Rudolph and all the rest of
right.
it. But it's also, I don't know, it's one of those ones that's really very hard to pin down. Because so many different things seem to have affected it at various times. I mean, funny enough, I was talking to someone this earlier today, and he said, don't forget to tell them why Rudolph has a red nose. And I go, well, because it's in the song. And he goes, no, it's because it was a memory of them taking mushrooms, you know, the fly agaric mushroom with the red spots, which, of course, makes you feel as if you're flying, I'm told. so, you know, I think that probably had something to do with why that happened. But the elves, well, the elves again come mostly out of the northern tradition, because like all the fairy traditions, there a lot of them come out of those particular countries. And I think that I may be wrong on this one. I won't put my entire reputation online by saying this is true, but my memory of it is that they. At some point, the whole idea of, you know, if Santa had to bring all these toys, they must get made.
Right.
Therefore, he had to have a workshop. Therefore, he had to have helpers. And what better to have helpers than these magical creatures that could make things magically?
Right.
So there's a logic to it. But I suspect that it came over a period of maybe 100 years of just the gradual accumulation of these ideas. I mean, this is what all this is about. As I said, go back to that initial point, lighting the fire, and then as you move forward, gradually another bit comes in from here, another bit comes in from there,
right,
until you have most of the stuff that we do today.
So who was first, the elves or the reindeer in the sleigh?
Elves first, definitely. I mean, the sleigh comes out of, you know, the whole Lapland traditions. Obviously, reindeer and sleigh very important to those people because mm-hmm. because that's how they get around.
Right.
You know, and I mean, obviously, somebody, again, we don't know who, must have thought, well, that would be a really useful thing for Santa to get around on. Right. That was before they started to think about how does he manage to get around the world and, you know, and do all this at the same, all in a few minutes, you know, in a few hours. And nobody's really explained that one yet.
Right.
Except by magic, of course.
I was going to say, yeah. And then the flying, of course, that probably came into play when it comes to thinking about how he got around the world quickly.
Yeah, you'd have to, really. I mean, there's a logic to it, you know, that you can't always put your finger on exactly where an idea came from, but you can see it emerging gradually. You know, you'll see the song, you know, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer mm-hmm. song, which of course became the anthem for Coca-Cola as well, and became involved in their advertising. It's got all the things. We know the names of the reindeer. We know that he carries this big sack and that he gets down chimneys, and all of that's in there. Even the ho 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 is in there. But I think before that, ho 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 simply comes out of how do you urge reindeer on? You go ho ho ho. So suddenly it's become his cry, you know?
So this was like Victorian age when the elves and also the reindeer. But Rudolph didn't come in to play right at first because it was probably just Dasher, Dancer, and Prancer, and Vixen, all the others. Is that correct? Because a lot of times I see just eight tiny reindeer, but then here come Rudolph being the ninth to lead the way.
No, that's all from the song. It's all from the song.
Just from the song. That's where it came up.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing how powerful that song has been in the way it's made us see that particular aspect of Christmas. Before that, yes, probably he did fly in a sleigh.
Right.
He probably did ride on a sleigh that was drawn by reindeer, but they didn't all have names and characters and characteristics. I mean, I've read somewhere that the guy who wrote that song, I said Clemens earlier, but I think that's wrong. I can't remember now who did, but he wanted to name them all because he wanted to give them individual characteristics. So he came up with those names. Nobody'd heard of Dasher and Prancer and Donner and Blitzen and all of that until that poem.
Oh my gosh.
And then it's become part of, you know, tradition now.
Yeah, Clement Clark Moore.
That's the guy. That's the one. But, you know, he created a large chunk of the modern history, the modern mythology of Christmas.
1820.
Just with that song. So it's interesting. I mean, it's unusual to be able to point to one person and say that's where that comes from, but there's no trace of it. There he is. Doesn't look that happy, does he?
No, it doesn't. Not for somebody that created an amazing song.
He just loved the story, and he, you know, created this new poem and song, and that was it. And so so much of the modern things have come in because of that.
So that I'm going to show this picture because I love these old pictures here. There the night before Christmas.
Yes, that's right.
So you said something about they sat around and sang Christmas carols. What would be, I mean, this one definitely has been around a while, but do you know what's the oldest Christmas carol that you can see that we still sing or besides this one?
Well, I mean, Silent Night is quite early. That's 18th century, 17th century, 17th. Sorry. But the idea of the carol is actually medieval. There are a lot of medieval carols that are still sung, but they've usually been given new words to bring them up to date. But the
right.
tunes are there. I don't think there's one particular one that you can point to. There are loads and loads of recordings of medieval carols, and they do, a lot of them are the same, you know, as we sing today. and the same tunes, but they you wouldn't recognize them necessarily.
Right, right.
Because in those days, no orchestra, no piano, no guitar, just voice.
Right.
Still very beautiful. So there again comes out, and that comes out of the beginning of the serious celebration of Christmas, which as I say, at the height of the Middle Ages, where you had these huge feasts, the idea of bringing in the boar's head, the boar's head carol, which is a very early one as well. That's from here in Oxford. We still have one of the colleges here. They still bring in the boar's head and process it round the table and sing the song and everything. So that's been kept going. But yeah, there are many others. There are many others that date from a much earlier period, although most of the ones that we tend to sing every day, you know, mostly date from the 19th century.
With one thing that we talked about, you said Santa Claus could have been a shaman, but we also talk about magic, which would be a warlock, I guess, a male version of a witch. Would you say that could be true, and I'm surprised because of the magic that Santa Claus brings, a lot of times Christianity doesn't look at magic or psychics or any of that type of stuff as being part of the Christian faith. Kind of contradicts.
This is one of those things that, you know, it would become very easily a head-to-head clash, I think, if they sat down and really talked about it.
Right.
I mean, obviously, I think the church has had to accept the inevitability of the commercial side of Christmas,
right,
which is represented by Santa Claus. But then Santa means saint. So it's Saint Claus. It's Sinterklaas, you know, it was the original of that. And the original was saints, so it's acceptable for that reason. But again, of course, the two things, the magical side of it, I mean, our ancestors would have recognized that because, I mean, what we think of as magic today is mostly commercialized as well. You know, the witches and wizards of today, not exclusively, but quite a lot of them are basically almost... I don't know how to put it, really. I'll offend them all, whatever I say. They're kind of being in tune with the time, if you like. Magic of that kind is very popular at the moment. I do a lot of work with tarot and things like that.
Oh,
I designed
great.
A lot of tarots. And so I come across this a lot. But it's like the magic is a way of explaining things you don't understand.
Right.
And the earliest form of science is magic. You get alchemy, which happens in between when they're still invoking, you know, elemental powers, but at the same time looking at the way in which the combination of certain elements creates an effect. So they're the proto-scientists. And so before that, you've got the kind of science which we call magic, which accounts for stuff that you can't account for.
Right.
So if someone appears and disappears in a puff of smoke, it's magic. Nowadays, we'd say it's SFX. But, you know, it's like, you see what I mean?
Well, I love this. And we're going to go into the last part because we just have about 5-6 minutes left, and I can't believe it's went so fast. But did the commercial part become such a big part of Santa Claus? Because, you know, for me, it does take away from what we've been talking about. A lot of the traditions that where people just, you know, getting together and gift giving and you know, wishing for the springtime. And, you know, there's so many things that were so good that brought people together. But when the commercial became part of it, you know, now people are, they go into debt. They, you know, the kids don't get what they want, so they throw a fit. I mean, they've lost kind of what the meaning of Christmas has, you know, started out as. So when did the commercial part come in?
Well, I mean, pretty much from the beginning of the 20th century onward. You know, I mean, it was already beginning to happen at the end of the 19th, because it was about, consumerism was there, you know, and for the first time, people had disposable income. Until then, they'd probably just had enough to live off if they were lucky. But suddenly they had disposable income. The wealthy, particularly in the Victorian era, were the ones who first started bringing in the Christmas trees, and then there were the gifts put under, and the gifts got bigger.
Right.
And, you know, what can I say? From there on, there's a spiral that's out of control, almost as it's become now. During the last 2 years, and we've had difficulties at Christmas with lockdowns and the pandemic, all people have talked about is how do I get my presents to my family?
Right.
Not how do I get to see my family?
Right.
But I, you know, if I can send a message out there with this, I would say that you can still celebrate all of the things we've been talking about. You can keep the presents. That's fine. No one's saying you shouldn't. And it's a time for kids, and kids love new things and toys and whatever. But why not also remember some of the other things? Why not decorate your house with intention, using live greenery rather than plastic? Why not have a real tree in your house?
Right.
Unless you have cats and dogs, of course, in which case maybe not. But, and try to remember that this isn't just about, the celebration of the Christian myth. It's about celebrating the whole myth of the new year, of the old year dying and the new year coming back in, and all of those things that are still important, you know, perhaps more at this time than ever. I mean, you know, when we look at the future, it doesn't always look so bright right now, but we hope that it's going to be okay. So this is a good time to think about what gives you hope and joy and to let that out, you know.
I agree with you. And I think it seems like a lot of people, even with are reevaluating because of the pandemic that we're going through, are reevaluating their life and their jobs, and they're quitting their jobs because they're not happy. And maybe this is a good time to reevaluate how they celebrate Christmas and birthdays and all kinds of different holidays of, you know.
It's not just about the presents.
Right.
Really.
And getting the book, The Winter Solstice and the Sacred Traditions of Christmas. I think this would really bring people a lot of joy, because they're like, wait a minute, there was a celebration before the commercial part of it. So people did it for centuries. So, John, I'm definitely going to have you back, because you have so many other, you said 150 books out there. And you're a folklorist, and I'm excited to talk about so many of these other folklore that we've talked about for generations, and it would be great to have you back in the new year.
I'd be glad to. I've enjoyed it. It's been great.
Well, happy Christmas, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to you and your wife. I appreciate you being on the show.
And happy solstice, Yule, and all those other things to you and all your listeners.
And all the listeners, please go to hallowquest.org.uk, and you can look at all the books John and his wife. Is it Caitlin?
It's Kathleen.
Kathleen.
The Irish spelling.
Between the two of them, around 200 books. That'll give you a lot of reading.
Not all in print, I'm afraid, but there's still quite a few, certainly.
Oh, I'm sure we can.
We're very happy to sign copies for you and all that. But
that would be awesome.
And if you're in the States, do remember that postage is horrific now from here.
I'm sure it is. So give it a little extra. Thank you, John. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Truth Be Told. And please, you know, from Robert Hensley and Bonnie Burkhead and myself, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. We'll do a New Year's Eve show, but about astrology and what's coming up in the new year. So until then, I'm Tony Sweet, and you take care of yourself. I'll see you on the other side. This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBN Go Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media. Facebook, Truth Be Told Radio. Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Normal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.